So good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to this year's Moses Passer Lectureship. And Moses Passer was a Cornell PhD, and he got his degree with A.T. Blomquist in 1948. And he was a professor at University of Minnesota before he later on became the education secretary at the American Chemical Society. So under his direction at the ACS, the education efforts of ACS have flourished extremely and became models for scientific societies, both domestic and abroad. Now, it is to honor Moses Passer, this lecture was endowed. And this year, we have Dr. Robert Klingberg, and who will be introduced by Professor Fried.
It's my pleasure to introduce Bob Klingberg, who is today's Passer lecturer. Let me give a little background about Bob, some of which you can find in the flyer. Bob, originating from California, got his bachelor's in chemistry. He's first and foremost the background of a chemistry at Berkeley, but then went on to UC San Diego to work as a graduate student in physics, working with the group, the physics group in low temperature physics, that was in direct competition with what was going on at Cornell. And in a way, we can call that in 1971-72 his first contact with Cornell. Unfortunately for the group at San Diego, headed by Wheatley, it was our group at Cornell that discovered the new superfluid phase of helium, and it's Bob who both witnessed that event and went on to do, nevertheless, a fine PhD in low-temperature physics. So that's a beginning of an indication of his wide background. He followed it with postdoc at Exxon and has been, for a number of years, associated with Schlumberger, where he is now a technical lead of unconventional resources, where he makes use unconventional resources, new energy sources, dealing and solving problems relating to current known energy sources, and benefits greatly from his background in chemistry, physics, and now geology, and a wide range of applications. And I'll conclude with a little personal story of when I met Bob in 1993 in Würzburg, Germany. Why? We were there for a meeting on magnetic resonance imaging and microscopy. And a friend of mine, I don't know whether of Bob's, an old friend of mine who was also coming to the meeting, had gotten on a rented car and was driving from Scandinavia direct to Würzburg, Germany. And we all got together in the hotel we were staying, and Larry, this friend, said, "Come on, join me in the car, and we'll drive to the lecture halls at the university." And someone I didn't know, turned out to be Bob, he's laughing already, jumped in the car with us, and then the three of us started off, and Larry, the driver, who had driven all the way from Scandinavia, said, "I don't know how to get over to the university in Würzburg. I don't know my directions here." So this is 1993, before most of us knew of what was going to happen. Bob pulled out this gadget, opened it up, located our exact latitude and longitude and got us to the university. And that's the first time I had heard of a GPS, which the oil prospecting people, among others, were using already professionally to locate where they were in a vast field. So that's going from chemistry, low temperature physics, to very practical applications. Please, Bob.
Well, thank you, Jack, for that introduction. It did make me laugh because I hadn't thought about that incident in quite a long time. And it was, just for those of you who weren't there, it was sort of like the clown car, you know, where you stuff an incredible number of bodies into a very, very small vehicle. That's what it was like. And yeah, as far as the GPS is concerned, I was and am a big user, but not professionally. I was using it for hiking, to hike around Danbury, Connecticut, and West Point, New York, and places like that. So sort of much more recreational than professional. But I am indeed, it's a pleasure and an honor to be here to talk to you today and present this year's Moses Passer Lecture. Dr. Passer, as you've heard, was committed to education. And it's in that spirit that I address you today. Natural gas production from the Marcellus Shale has generated tremendous public interest and concern. And as scientists, we are obligated to help educate the public as to the potential benefits and risks associated with this important resource. So first, we have to educate ourselves and each other. And so I'm going to present my point of view, and I'm looking forward to hearing from you what your point of view is. So we can get started. Let's see, get rid of that. So the title of my talk is Marcellus Shale Science and Technology, and that's going to be the emphasis. I do understand there's a significant concern about this particular resource because you're sort of in the middle of it. Here's Ithaca, New York. The gray area on this map of the northeastern United States is the area underlain by Marcellus Shale. You're sort of actually sort of at the edge. You might not be economic here, but you're certainly close enough to be influenced. The trend goes through the southern tier of New York, much of Pennsylvania, all of West Virginia, and a side of Ohio. So it's quite a big deal here in the Northeast. For those of us who are gas consumers in Cambridge, Massachusetts, it's a good thing because I expect that if this is developed, gas will be abundant and cheap for the rest of most of our lives. And so it's a significant new resource, as I said, but also one that does carry risks. And I think it's very important to understand the risks so that we can prioritize them. Good policy is based on knowing where the problems really are and not just where the problems might be perceived to be. And that's really going to be my emphasis today. This is an outline of what I'm going to be talking about for the next 50 minutes or so. First, I'm going to start with just a general overview of the energy economy of the United States and sort of the resource picture and how the Marcellus gas might fit into that. The second part will be petroleum geology, which might sound a little dry, but I think it's the most entertaining part of the talk. I'm going to say a little bit about geochemistry basically sort of some of the fundamentals of how gas is formed in the Earth. And finally, I'm going to end with a selection of environmental concerns. It's not going to be comprehensive, but I'm going to give you sort of a flavor of what I feel is a constructive approach to dealing with them. So first, let's start with the economics and resource section. I'm going to talk about energy supply and demand, the question of how fast can we decarbonize the economy, which is something I think probably most of us in this room are very interested in seeing happen. And then finally, a comment about whether natural gas is part of the problem or part of the solution or possibly both. So first, just an overview, and I apologize for this slide. I do strongly recommend that you go to the Lawrence Livermore National Lab website where you can see it in sort of bigger picture. But I'll just point out a few of the sort of salient properties. Basically, this is a picture of the entire energy system of the United States. In 2009, Lawrence Livermore makes these about every other year, so this is the latest. We used about 100 quadrillion British thermal units of energy, which is a lot of energy. And the big four sources are first oil. Oil's the biggest single one. And that goes predominantly into transportation with some industrial use. I'm not going to talk too much about that today, just sort of tangentially. Coal is a very important resource and basically goes entirely into electric generation. Nuclear is the red line, and that goes all into electric generation. Natural gas is sort of the most versatile of these energy sources. It has almost equally parts industrial, commercial, residential, and electric generation uses. Now, there's hydro here, which basically is a very good, sort of very clean source of energy, but one which we've pretty much played out here in the United States. All the rivers that are going to be dammed have been dammed. So that's kind of the end of that. That's not going to grow. So that leaves us with geothermal and renewables, which are solar, wind, geothermal, which together amount to about 1.5% of our total energy generation in this country. And, of course, we're putting a lot of hopes on that. The Obama administration has made it very clear that's a main priority for the administration, and I agree with that. But it's at this point, a rather small piece of the entire puzzle. The entire puzzle is very big. In 2009, we spent about $1.2 trillion on energy. So it's a very, very big ship. You can imagine the Queen Mary, having to steer the Queen Mary, it's a big turning radius. So that's an important point that you should keep in mind. Yes.
Can you say what is meant by rejected energy on that chart?
Yeah. So, for example, with electricity, that's a good example. We only, of the fuel that's burned, you only get about one-third of it in terms of useful energy. So you put in a gigajoule of coal energy, you only get a third of a gigajoule on the electric power line. So the rest is waste heat. So electricity is a rather versatile but quite inefficient way to distribute energy. Gas, on the other hand, is burned in your own home and has a very high efficiency, for example. So just to reinforce this point, that this is a very, very big part of the economy that we can't expect to change too terribly quickly. This is a sort of interesting overview of how of the sources of energy used in the United States over the last 150, 160 years. Back in the middle of the 19th century, we were a wood-burning economy. But it became clear in the latter part of the 19th century that coal was a better fuel, it was a more efficient fuel, and it displaced wood. It took about 50 years to displace wood with coal. Early in the last century, the 20th century, oil became available, and it was viewed as even a better fuel because it was even more versatile and a good deal more cleanly burning and much more useful for transportation purposes, and it started displacing coal. But again, that transition took about 50 years. In about the 1930s, natural gas became available in large quantities, and that's even more cleaner burning, even more versatile, even easier to get around in pipelines. And again, that transition has been slow. So I think this gives us sort of a historical perspective as to how fast things can change. Now, renewables, I don't even know if you can see it. It's this sort of purple bar up there. That's about 1%. Just imagine how long it's going to take for that purple bar to get to be a significant size. We all are interested in renewable energy. We all want to see it happen. but I don't want anybody thinking it's going to happen tomorrow. I was thinking about this the other day on the flight, in fact. If somehow we made burners 2% more effective, that would be equivalent to doubling our base of renewable energy. So it's a different scale of problem. Doesn't mean we shouldn't work on it, but it does mean it's not going to happen tomorrow. Let's look at natural gas in particular, which is part of our present energy mix. This is, a historical perspective on a slightly smaller time scale of what's been going on in natural gas since 1990. These numbers are put together by the Potential Gas Committee at the Colorado School of Mines. Again, they put out a report about every other year. Back in 1990, we were using about 20 trillion cubic feet of natural gas a year. Now, a cubic foot in the gas industry is like a standard cubic foot in chemistry, except instead of 0 degrees C and 1 atmosphere, it's 60 degrees F and 1 atmosphere, so it's a slightly different cubic foot, but the same idea. And basically, that has been increasing at about 1% a year, which is slower than the growth of the economy since 1990. And now we're, in 2008, we were up to about 23 TCF a year. Now, during that period, we maintained a 50-year supply of gas. What that means is that we were discovering gas about as quickly as we were using it, and that's a good thing. I mean, it's sort of a stable situation. But in the last 3 or 4 years, something quite remarkable has happened. And we've sort of jumped up from a 50-year supply, which we were sort of happy with, up to an 80-year supply. And that entire increment was due to the onset of production of shale gas. So it's an immense resource. And by the way, this bar is going to get even bigger in the next report, because this was just the tip of the iceberg. So this has really changed the entire picture. Now, not only has gas suddenly become more abundant, but it's also become much cheaper. Right now, gas at wholesale is about $4 an MCF, which is really, adjusted for inflation, historically low. And a report out of MIT this last summer predicted that it will not go above $6 an MCF for decades. So we have a very abundant and very cheap source of gas that's a relatively clean fuel as these things go. So just to emphasize, in case I have to convince you of this, that shale gas is important. This is one way in which it's important. This is a comparison of prices, again, over the last few years on an equivalent energy basis. So basically, these are all prices normalized to a given amount of energy, which in this case happens to be a barrel of oil. It used to be that gas and oil prices were coupled because they were basically competing. You could either generate electricity with gas or oil. Well, what's happened is that gas has completely displaced oil in electric generation. If you remember the first slide, there is no oil going to electric generation anymore. And now, gas and oil have gotten decoupled, but gas and coal have gotten coupled because now gas is starting to push coal out of electric generation. And the coal companies are very, very worried when they see this graph. So this is a major policy issue as to how much we want to promote this or not, or what to do about it or nothing. But one thing that you are all probably aware of is that the electric power that you use here in Ithaca comes from 3 nearby coal-burning power plants, which together generate 600 megawatts, which is a lot of energy, and emit 3.8 million tons of carbon dioxide a year. So some of these plants have CO2 scrubbers, some don't, I think, at least the latest information I was able to find. And there are issues of, for example, pollution from coal ash. So it's a manifold, complicated problem, and I'm not saying gas is the ultimate answer, but it's a major policy issue as to how we want to deal with this competition between coal and gas. And that's sort of a kind of social background for this. There are other benefits of abundant, low-cost natural gas. As our renewables increase as a proportion of our energy use, we're going to need a backup for the intermittency of those power sources. As you know, the wind doesn't always blow, the sun doesn't always shine, and in a practical matter, the natural gas is really the best way of dealing with peak power, peak loads. It can be turned on and off very quickly, much faster than a coal-fired plant. And so here, I must say, perhaps a little sense of humor here. I took this photograph out in Boston Harbor. This is liquefied natural gas tanks from Everett Terminal. And here they have sort of two demonstration windmills. This isn't too terribly serious, but it does illustrate the fact that these guys actually do work together. The other use for an abundant and low-cost source of gas would be to replace gasoline and diesel as a transportation fuel. Now, that's already happening in Asia. The United States is far behind, as we are in so many ways. But it can work, and in Boston, we do have a fleet of these compressed natural gas buses, which Boston MBTA is very proud of, you know, cleaner burning, you know, economical, et cetera, et cetera. The important issue here is that we are spending, I don't know if you're aware of this, we are spending $1 billion a day importing oil. How many people knew that? Okay, a scattering. $1 billion a day importing oil. If we can produce gas and you use gas to run buses, that sounds like a good thing to me. Okay, so enough about the kind of economic overview. Let's look at some petroleum geology, which I promised was going to be the most fun part of the talk, surprisingly. Questions are, how do oil and gas form? Second question, why is shale gas easier to find than conventional gas? And thirdly, why is there natural gas in New York State? So we need to understand some of the how oil and gas are generated in the earth. So basically, it all starts with organic matter that is deposited in lake beds or shallow marine environments that are anoxic. Now, if you have oxygen in the water, the organic matter will quickly be oxidized before it really can collect. So you really need a situation like the Black Sea, for example, which is anoxic at the bottom. I believe the Eastern Mediterranean is also. Any place that has very abundant life so that organic matter is decaying faster than oxygen can be replenished becomes anoxic. So you can have a shallow sea connected to a bigger sea that might be as saturated with oxygen but still be anoxic for local purposes. And so that's the starting point. Now, the first thing that happens is that the bacteria start working on it, and that's produces what's called biogenic methane. Methanogens produce it. That works up to 50 to 80 degrees centigrade, and bacteria actually like 37 degrees C. That's kind of physiologic temperature. The higher it goes, the less comfortable they are. About 80, they sort of give up. But biogenic methane is pervasive in the subsurface. You find it in many, many places, and that's a recent breakdown product. As the remaining organic matter is buried by natural geologic processes, which we'll discuss more in a minute, it's exposed to the geothermal gradient of the Earth, which is about 30 degrees C per kilometer. And as it is buried and warms up, then you start having the possibility of the organic molecules breaking down into hydrocarbons. Oil is first. When you get to about 70 or 80 degrees centigrade, that starts happening. But don't try this at home, because at home you have to heat the organic matter to about 500 degrees centigrade to produce oil in an hour. But if you have 10 or 100 million years, then it'll actually go at below 100 degrees C at a satisfactory rate. The kinetics are the same, but you have a lot of time for a relatively low temperature reaction. That continues until burial takes the organic matter down into the gas window, which kicks in at about 120 or 130 degrees C, then you start producing gas. Finally, when all is done and you've extracted all the hydrocarbon you're going to, you wind up with something very graphitic. So that's sort of the overview of how oil and gas is formed in the Earth. Now, let's look at the Earth and see how that kind of works out in the real world. So all this is going on in this magenta band that's called source rock. So source rock is something that is rich in organic matter. And I have on the lecture table over there put a piece of Marcellus shale, which is 7% total organic carbon, probably 15 to 20% organic matter by volume. And you'll pick it up and see what it's like. This stuff is 400 million years old, and it's dirty and black and carbonaceous. Next to it is a piece of Dunkirk shale that I collected at an outcrop south of Buffalo, New York. And you'll see that it's quite a different sort of beast altogether. It has a very low organic content. But basically, this organic-rich, shaley material is what's called source rock. Now, as the stuff gets buried and heated and starts generating oil and gas is much less dense than kerogen, which is the compressed dead algae that the whole thing starts with. So it's got to go somewhere. It expands. If it can find a fluidic path, it will take it. So here, for example, a fault in the earth or a fracture, or maybe just by the expansion, the source rock will create its own fractures in rock above it, and that's been observed. Basically, that gives the oil and gas a migration pathway. Now, eventually, it often winds up at the surface of the Earth at a seep. And that's probably been the fate of almost all the buried organic material over the hundreds of millions of years of Earth history. But sometimes, in a very lucky combination of circumstances, it will hit a band of permeable and porous rock underneath a cap rock, which is impermeable, which will trap it. So, and in the right geometry, that it's a trap, because oil and gas float on water. It's a buoyancy-driven system, and it needs to have a cap, or else it'll just go away. So you need this cap, this impermeable cap, and the reservoir has to be pretty porous and permeable to be economically interesting. So it's a very lucky and somewhat rare combination of circumstances that gives you a conventional oil and gas reservoir, and that's why they're so darn hard to find. So the industry has spent the last, 120, 130 years perfecting exploration geophysics, which is a very sophisticated and difficult field, to find these little pockets. Now, the shale gas is really quite a different animal because it has never left the source rock. It is still in the source rock. And the source rock doesn't rely on a very lucky combination of circumstances. It's just a very broad area. It's as big as that lake or that inland sea that the organic matter was deposited in. So, and you could drill almost anywhere in it and find gas. So it's like a no-lose proposition. It's actually more like coal, where you have laterally extensive beds that don't require a lot of sophisticated exploration geophysics to find. So what did the world look like when the Marcellus Shale laid down? It was weirdly different than today. Marcellus Shale is about 370, 400 million years old. This is what the world looked like then. And anything that you think you recognize is a false cognate. what the core of what will become North America was sitting at the equator, rotated here. It was about to be collided by Africa in a series of events that would go on for another 100 million years. Siberia was up there in the northern hemisphere. Well, that's a good thing. Kazakhstan was down there. China was a bunch of islands. But most of the landmass was sort of near the South Pole in this giant Gondwana continent. Weird. Anyway, things have changed since then. But this is sort of the geology that you have to understand where this stuff comes from. Now, this is a sort of magnified view of what North America looked like. And now it's been rotated. so that it has the orientation of the present United States. The equator is here. The continent was just south of the equator. It was a rather hot and dry continent. The Appalachian Range was one of the largest topographic features on Earth at the time and would be getting even bigger. New York and Pennsylvania are right here in this sort of estuary. Now, the estuary was tens to maybe a few hundred meters deep, shallow sea, quite productive. And it filled up rather quickly. The Marcellus Shale was laid down incredibly fast, I think in just 1 or 2 million years, so which is fast as far as these geological things are concerned. Texas down there, California was a bunch of offshore islands, and so on. But what's happening is that Africa is about to give us a real wallop. So this is what's called a burial history. I love these charts. You can really learn a lot from them. This is for north central Pennsylvania. Basically, Marcellus laid down, they say, 400 million years ago. That's about right. And then it was rapidly buried. It took 100 million years, but that's kind of rapid on a geological timescale. As Africa overrode the North American continent and pushed down that inland sea that we were looking at. So when the Marcellus reached about 70 degrees C, it started producing oil, which is the red band. When it hit about 120 degrees C, it started producing gas, which is the pink band. And then at about 300 million years ago, the collision was over. There was one giant continent called Pangaea. And then things sort of calmed down. And erosion took place. The Atlantic Ocean started opening up about 200 million years ago. And really, it's been sort of all downhill from there. Basically, the Appalachians and this area to the west have been eroding steadily. And now that shale, which had reached a depth of 11,000 feet, is now in north central Pennsylvania back up to 6,000. And here in Ithaca, it's about 3,500. So a lot has gone on over the hundreds of millions of years. Let's go on to some geochemistry and sort of look at the chemical processes that are occurring while all this geology is happening. So the questions here are, what are the chemical pathways from organic matter to oil and gas? How do we distinguish biogenic from thermogenic gas? And how do the physical properties of shale change as a result of oil and gas generation? Now, there are many, many more chemical questions than this, believe me. I was one of the people that said that we should have more chemistry to really study this resource. And we do have a great deal of chemical activity, but in the confines of this talk, you're not going to get all of it. The point of view here is that by understanding the geochemistry, that will help us understand the environmental challenges, as you will see. So I've been talking about this kerogen, which is this compressed dead algae. And what does it look like? Well, this is what you would call an artist's conception of the kerogen molecule. Of course, it really doesn't exist. It doesn't have a distinct chemical composition. But this is put together out of what you can imagine to be familiar combination of all kinds of measurements and then sort of put together into a notional molecule. So we measure a certain concentration of aromatic moieties, some cyclos, carboxyls, ketos, alkanes, and so on, and sort of put that all together. We can measure a molecular weight, which turns out to be something like 25 kilodaltons. Hydrogen to carbon ratio is good. It's about 1.34 hydrogens per carbon, which is a very high-grade source, and 51% of the carbon is aliphatic. So this is a good-grade material. Now, after it has gone through heating or pyrolysis and generated oil and gas, the remainder isn't so nice. It's been broken up, so now the molecular weight is about 8 kilodaltons. Only 28% of the carbon is aliphatic. A lot of the rest has been split off to produce oil. Think about octane as kind of a typical product. And then a lot has gone off as gas, methane, propane, butane, ethane, and so on. So H to C ratio is therefore much lower because we have much more aromatic and condensed ring compounds. So now we're down to 0.73. And as I said, only 28% aliphatic carbon. So this is sort of the natural progression of this material. So how do we distinguish the gas that comes off from that process from the gas that's produced by methanogens in the shallow subsurface? And I think probably most of you know this already, but for the few of you who don't, I'll just relate this, that there are three simple fingerprinting methods. Two of them are stable isotope analysis, and one is higher hydrocarbon gas analysis. So basically, microbes enzymatically breaking down kerogen basically like light reactants, makes the enzymatic reaction go faster if they're using C12 instead of C13 and 1H instead of deuterium. So what you find is that bacterial gas or biogenic gas is strongly enriched in C12 and hydrogen relative to the natural abundance of those in nature. Now, thermogenic gas is much, thermogenic processes are much less fussy, and they will break down to materials that are much closer to natural abundance, so that you see that on the carbon isotope ratios, we're closer to natural abundance with thermogenic gas than with biogenic gas, and we're closer to natural abundance of hydrogen with thermogenic gas than with biogenic gas. Now, the third thing to look at is the higher hydrocarbons, the ethane, propane, butane. And methanogens don't make them. They're methanogens. They make methane. So if you have a gas that is nothing but methane, it's probably biogenic, whereas the thermogenic gases are much more of a natural gas mixture. So this is important. For example, if you have gas in your well, it's important to know where it came from. And so this is obviously the first, simplest analysis you can do. Looking at some physical changes, and this turns out to be of considerable practical importance. This organic matter is laid down, as I said, in lakes and shallow seas that are quiet, very quiescent, low energy, what geologists call low energy environments. So you get layers of clay, which are generally transversely isotropic and layered, and that's where that shaley or slaty habit comes from in that kind of rock. And then in between, you have more kerogen-rich layers. And the kerogen is deposited as sort of small pieces of organic material, not necessarily connected with each other. Now, as I mentioned, as you go through this maturation process and the kerogen is cooked to produce oil and gas, which has a lower density, the oil and gas wants to find pathways out, and the kerogen, little kerogen pockets, tend to get connected up into sort of pathways which allow the oil and gas to escape. And this is actually something that was just realized, believe it or not, in the last few years. Largely on very close scanning electron microscopy of gas shale. Now, just to sort of introduce this idea of poor conductivity, let's look at what a typical good oil reservoir rock is, and that's in the upper left-hand corner. This is a SEM, obviously, 50 micron scale bar down here. You have these grains of sand that are cemented together, and then you have pores. This is what an oil reservoir looks like. So nobody in the room should think an oil reservoir is a big lake. It is not. It is more like a sponge, but the pore spaces of the sponge are quite fine. In fact, and a really good sponge, a really good oil reservoir, it approximates the size of a human hair. So that's how big the pore in a really good porous rock is. It's amazing you can produce oil from it, but it's true. And I have an example, by the way, it's also sitting on the lecture table, of a quite good rock that would be a good oil reservoir. It's a quarried rock, but it's a Massillon sandstone from Ohio. And you'll see what a good reservoir rock is, what petroleum geologists really love. Now, gas shale, not so good. The upper right-hand corner is an SEM of gas shale, and this whole picture would fit into this small red square here. On this picture, this is a 500 nanometer scale bar, so now we've blown the thing up by a factor of 100. And the pores, instead of being these sort of nice open, you know, cavities as big as a human hair, are now much smaller. They're on the order of 50 nanometers. This is really important. And you will see why in a couple of minutes. But first, let's go on to the environmental concerns. So as I said, I'm not going to talk about everything, can't possibly talk about everything, but I will address these few issues, which are things that I have more expertise about than I do in other issues. Firstly, surface disturbance. Secondly, pollution of drinking water, and in particular, the effects of hydraulic fracturing and hydraulic isolation. So let's look at surface disturbance first. This is a conventional gas field in Wyoming, the Jonah Field. It's a relatively new one. It's 33 square miles in area. It was developed in what you would call a cost-effective or cheap manner, I guess you would say, with 16 to 32 vertical wells per square mile. Clearly, some surface disturbance has gone on. There is an interesting mitigation story, and you might look at the Nature Conservancy magazine in the winter of 2008 for that. But basically, probably you don't want your landscape to here in the Northeast to look like this. But that's not how gas shale is developed. This would be a more typical gas shale development. Now, what we're looking at here is a map view or a plan view. So we're looking down from above with north-south this way, east-west this way. This is a square mile in Oklahoma. And like I say, you don't need a lucky little reservoir for gas shale. You could just take a whole square mile and start drilling. But you don't need to drill the whole square mile. What's happened here is that they've drilled six wells along one line. And what's happened is that these wells are vertical here, so you can't see the vertical part. It's going down 6,000 to 8,000 feet, which is where their reservoir is in Oklahoma. And then the drill bit is turned to drill horizontally through this 170-foot thick bed. Now, that probably sounds weird for those of you who haven't heard about this, but it is possible to steer drill bits and drill horizontally for a mile or more. Those of you who are interested, I have a slide. I don't have it in the talk. It takes a few minutes to explain. You'll have to believe me that it's possible and, in fact, common these days, and not all that expensive to do. So the result of this is that you have a square mile of resource, but you're only drilling six or eight wells along a road, and the rest of the square mile, you have no idea there's anything going on underneath. So this is a good thing, and it's also a very economical thing. Now, the wells are going to be 500 feet to 1,000 feet apart. So, and there's gas that needs to be collected to the well, right? And it needs to flow through the rock. So now we have to understand the flow of fluids through porous media. That's this slide. The equation that controls the flow of fluid through porous media is Darcy's law. It's basically the same as Ohm's law. You have a volume rate of flow per unit area, flux, Q, which is sort of like current. You have a driving term, the pressure gradient, which is sort of like voltage. And then you have this ratio of K over mu, which is sort of like conductivity. K is the permeability of the rock, and it's a property only of the rock. And basically, it expresses how efficiently a fluid can flow through. It's proportional to the square of the pore size. And so if you have big pores, flow is relatively efficient, conductivity is high. Small pores, not so good. The denominator is the fluid viscosity. So you have in the numerator the frame contribution and the denominator the fluid contribution. Obviously, the smaller the viscosity, the faster things flow. We understand that. So let's look at some magnitudes of these numbers. First of all, you need to understand a darcy is the unit of hydraulic permeability. It's 10 to the minus 12 meters squared, approximately. And if you take a water filter like you might use in your swimming pool, if you have a swimming pool, that's good for about 10 darcies. So you probably have some concept of a very coarse filter. Maybe your water filter at home might be a darcy. A really good oil reservoir would be a tenth of a darcy. Gas shale, 10 to the minus 7 darcies. This R squared is just killing you. I told you about those 50 nanometer pores instead of the 50 micrometer pores. That's good for 6 orders of magnitude in permeability. So that's a killer. That is a killer. Now, you get some of that back because gas has a much lower viscosity than oil. Okay, so typical good oil has viscosity of about 1 centipoise, the same as water. Natural gas, 100 times less. That's a good thing. But you're still down 4 orders of magnitude in your volume rate of flow. What to do? Well, here's a picture of the well. This is sort of a view down the well bore. And you've got the pressure that's sort of driving the fluid into the well. The only way to make this work faster with that low density of wells that I was telling you about, the 6 to 8 per square mile, is to enlarge the well bore by fracturing the surrounding rock. That essentially exposes a larger area to flow, so the gas doesn't have to flow as far. It only has to flow from here to here instead of here to here. Pretty easy to understand conceptually. Now, here's the bad part. Fracturing subsurface rock is a really big deal. And probably many of you have seen pictures like this. It's an industrial scale operation. It involves typically 3 million gallons of water, 1,000 tons of sand, some other chemicals. And so it's a big deal. There's a lot of truck traffic on the roads. It's not the sort of thing you would want to do in a public water supply watershed like the Catskills watershed of New York City. This would be a bad idea, just from the truck traffic alone. On the other hand, 3 million gallons sounds like a lot of water, but it's actually 10 acre feet, which is actually not that much compared to what you need to irrigate a golf course for a season, and it's certainly very small compared to any agricultural use. So the amount of water in itself is not a problem, but there are other problems. Unfortunately, I would say that clarity has been lacking in the fracturing debate, and I think some of these comments might be familiar to some of you in the audience. Fracking is a process in which drillers blast millions of gallons of water, sand, and hazardous chemicals at high pressure into subsurface rock formations. Blast. This technique, which used for much of today's natural gas extraction, shoots chemicals mixed with millions of gallons of sand and water thousands of feet underground. So you have these sort of emotional words like blast and shoot. On the other hand, you have rather what I would call anodyne statements from people like the American Petroleum Institute along the lines of, hydraulic fracturing has been used in nearly 1 million wells in the United States, and studies have confirmed no direct link between hydraulic fracturing operations and groundwater impacts. That is true, strictly speaking, but it does disguise a multitude of sins. So really, what is the truth here? Well, we're going to look at technology and really understand the process, and that's going to help us figure out what the truth is. So first of all, fracturing is not blasting and it's not shooting, I can assure you. Because it is such a big industrial scale operation, engineers don't waste money bringing in any extra trucks. They only bring in exactly what they need, so they need to understand exactly what they're doing. So the first thing you do is analyze the stresses in the earth, because this is what you need to overcome to create a fracture. Now, the largest stress in the earth is generally the vertical stress, which is basically the lithostatic load of the rock. And this is a chart. This is a depth scale from 19,000 to 23,000 feet. Stresses run from 15,000 psi to 21,000 psi. This is way higher than in any gas shale formation. This is actually from an oil reservoir example, but the principles are exactly the same. So the numbers, these particular numbers don't need to concern you. But the principles are the same. As you get deeper, stresses get higher. But basically, the largest stress is that vertical stress from the overburden of the rock. Then, and there are three principal stresses. There's the vertical one, and then there's two horizontal stresses, the maximum and minimum horizontal stress. And they're shown here in these purple and green lines. The smallest stress in the problem is the pore pressure, which basically supports the hydrostatic head. So you can imagine that water is in these pore spaces of rocks, more or less connected from the surface. Its density is only about half that of porous rock, so it has a substantially lower pressure than the vertical lithostatic stress. Now, all these things can be measured, and you can see there's data here. We have acoustic means of measuring the vertical and horizontal stresses, very clever, that's been worked out just in the last few years by Sinha et al. The vertical stress is estimated from measuring the density over the entire rock column, which is quite easy to do. And pore pressure can be obtained from a special fluid pore pressure monitoring instrument. So all this stuff is and can be measured. Now, the important point here is that what we need to do is increase the pore pressure enough to reach the minimum horizontal stress, because the minimum horizontal stress is the stress at which rock will part and a fracture will begin to propagate. So it's not 20,000 or 22,000 psi, it's not blasting, it's increasing the pressure by maybe, in this example, 2,000 psi. Now, probably most of us have in our labs gas bottles with 2,000 psi pressure, so we know what that's all about. It's not insignificant, but it's nothing out of this world. Moreover, it's not pneumatic pressure, it's hydraulic pressure, which means, and since water, which is basically what fracturing fluid is not compressible, whenever you propagate a fracture, the pressure goes down. So in order to keep the process going, you need to keep pumping. So it's not a blast, which is out of control. It's very much in control, and it takes hours to create fractures. So this is a process under control, as you'd expect to be, given the investment in resources that goes into the process. Now, moreover, the process can be monitored. And each dot, now this is the same plan view that I showed you before from this square mile in Oklahoma. Here are the six wells. Each dot is an acoustic emission event caused by the extension of a fracture over a period of hours. Now, the acoustic emissions are mapped the same way that earthquakes are mapped. Basically, you have three geophones in an array. You can probably figure out the trigonometry. And by triangulating, you know exactly where the acoustic emission event is taking place. And so you can tell exactly where the fracture is going. And this is a commercial service, not a big deal. It's not done on every job, of course. It's expensive. But it's done in every field so that the engineers can figure out what the stresses are and understand how to control the process. So more interestingly is the same sort of plot in vertical section. Now, here we're not looking at the map view anymore, but we're looking at, I guess, a sagittal view of the Earth. This is depth in feet. This is in the Barnett Shale in Texas. And then this is a distance along the surface, also in feet. And again, the same triangulation has been done. These are fracture events that are mapped. And the reason this is done is that petroleum engineers hate to fracture into water, because that will basically kill their well. They want to make a gas well, not a water well. So they really try to avoid water. Now, the water at this depth is all saline. It's not potable. In this area, you have an unusually deep base of treatable water. This is a technical term. You can drill down to about 850 feet and still get water you can treat for drinking water. But the top of the Marcellus Shale is something like 3,500 feet to 8,500 feet. So you have something like between a half mile and a mile and a half between the reservoir and your drinking water supply. And basically, when the American Petroleum Institute says that hydraulic fracturing has never been shown to blah, 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 this is what they're talking about. There's no hydraulic fracture that goes from the well up to the potable water. It just doesn't happen. But that doesn't mean there aren't problems. Let's look at a problem. Basically, there's wells. I've used the word well many times in this talk. You've probably noticed. Every well starts at the surface and goes down thousands of feet, and it goes through a drinking water aquifer. Now, that is sort of like taking a hypodermic needle and sticking it into your skin. If you are not careful about your sanitation, you will get an infection because you've broken that skin layer that protects you from all those nasty bacteria out there. Same is true with wells. Now, the antiseptic, so to speak, is a series of steel pipes and cement that basically seal off this more or less dirty well bore from what you want to keep clean, the potable water aquifer, which is shown here in blue in this sketch from ProPublica. Now, basically, if this cementing is done right, all is well, and the aquifer is hydraulically isolated from anything else. It's hydraulically isolated from fracture fluid, hydraulically isolated from natural gas, from biogenic gas, which might be pervasive in your subsurface, whatever. But we know that the cementing doesn't always work because those of you who followed the news last April know that a well blew out in the Gulf of Mexico, the Deepwater Horizon, with huge losses and huge environmental impact. Why? Bad cement job. Now, I'm on a Department of Energy committee appointed by Secretary Chu, and we were charged with sort of determining what is the biggest problem in gas shale development. Everyone at the table, running from small West Texas producers, you know, these good old boys, you know, George Bush friends, out to National Resources Defense Council, Amy Mall, we all agreed cementing is the biggest environmental problem connected with gas shale development. So this is where the problem is. Now, I don't know how many of you have seen Gasland. I watched it. It's a pretty interesting movie. I do recommend it. Available, you know, widely, Netflix, I think. And Gasland is good for showing you where there are problems, but it's not very good at explaining why the problems occurred. For that, I recommend this report, which came out of Tudor Pickering, which has a huge table, and this is just a very, very tiny extract of it. I couldn't show you the whole thing, where basically they go through every sort of environmental incident, and it's not a reply to Gasland, but it covers a lot of the same ground. But it goes through this all the sort of major environmental incidents and then reports what the state regulators found in their investigations. So here's sort of a very condensed part of their table. Dimock, Pennsylvania, water well explosion and gas in tap water. Reason? Bad cement job. This had nothing actually to do with shale gas. It was biogenic gas, as they determined from the molecular fingerprinting. But nonetheless, the bad cement job let that biogenic gas into the aquifer. Cato, Louisiana, gas escape. Reason? Bad cement job. Bainbridge, Ohio, gas explosion. Reason? Bad cement job. Pattern here? There are other things that can happen. Dimock, Pennsylvania, not a happy town. Polluted creek, surface spill. So this is your common garden variety industrial incident. Sack of chemicals, it gets very diluted in the fracturing process, but it comes to the well site concentrated. If that bag gets cut or broken and then it rains and you get a concentrated nitric acid or whatever it is, you will have a problem with your creek. Cato, Pennsylvania, 17 dead cattle, surface spill, same problem. Bag got broke. Dunkard Creek, Pennsylvania, fish kill. This was a wastewater discharge. This was when the water, you use the 3 million gallons, some of it comes back. When it comes back, it's very saline. You dump that into your local river, fish will die, I will tell you. So, you know, you need to be careful about how you deal with your wastewater. This is a real problem. So you know, when you actually look at the analyses, you find where are the real problems and what is it that we really need to regulate. You know, we need to regulate this industry, but we don't want to regulate the wrong things. That's the message that I'm sort of leaving with you. So just to summarize, firstly, there's a lot of inertia in the energy economy, the $1.2 trillion a year. It can change, but changes realistically take decades. Secondly, gas shale is a large, emerging source of natural gas, which can help meet our energy needs while reducing carbon dioxide emissions. But environmental consequences are a continuing concern. Understanding the science and technology will help us prioritize the risks and meet those concerns. So I'm just going to end with the super big picture. And thank you very much for your attention. Hope you learned something.
Questions for Dr. Kleinberg?
The cement issue. Mm-hmm. If it's done well, what would you project as sort of the duration that a good cement casing will last? And will that be long enough to prevent the migration of bad things up into the surface or the aquifers?
Yeah.
That's, you know, hard to answer in a precise way. It does last a long time. Yeah, like decades, many decades. Yeah, so, you know, basically, you can think of Texas as a pincushion. Texas has been thoroughly drilled. Oklahoma has been thoroughly drilled. Louisiana, thoroughly drilled. Believe it or not, they still have well water that they can drink there. So by and large, cement, I don't want to leave you with the impression that all cement jobs fail or that they fail quickly. By and large, they don't. But that is a weak point in the system. It's sort of like it's like a hypodermic. You need to sterilize. To answer your question directly, I can't give you a precise number, but it is many decades.
But is that long enough in terms of if you created, you know, the puncture in the skin is an analogy, but the skin closes over. Mm-hmm. And that won't close over. So what happens in 50 years?
Yeah. To tell you the truth, I don't know. I can't really answer that question, to be quite honest. Yes.
What is the lifetime of these wells? I don't think shale gas wells last 50 years.
No. The gas is pretty much played out in a matter of a few years, 3 years, 4 years.
But the puncture is there.
But the puncture remains. Exactly. So the point remains.
So we've been hearing that they're thinking about adding CO2 into the hydrofracking solution, that makes it even more effective in terms of recovering gas and shale.
Yeah.
Could you explain a little bit about how that might work?
Yeah, that is actually interesting, and it's a puzzle to me why that isn't used more, actually, because basically you pump in 3 million gallons, but you only get back 1 million gallons. That is not a good thing from the standpoint of gas production. You would like to get all of it back because that water is, whatever it's doing, it's not doing a good thing. So the idea is that if you pump down water that has dissolved CO2 in it, it's sort of like a soda bottle. You're pumping it in under pressure, several thousand PSI. Then when you want to get the water back, you sort of take the top off. Yeah, right. And you have what's called an energized fluid, which means that you've got CO2 bubbles basically pushing the water back out. That's been tried in Canada. On a test, it seemed to have worked, but it hasn't really hasn't been used much outside of that single field. I think the reason is that it turns out that just using basically just water, plain water with a few additives, is more effective than economically than putting in all this other stuff. I mean, CO2 actually costs money. Today, we actually get CO2 from other wells. It's kind of strange. We don't collect CO2 from industrial plants. We should, but we don't. So it's expensive. It has a cost. And, just using plain old water.
Okay.
seems to be the cost-effective approach as of now.
Is it feasible to recycle the water on site so that the truck traffic and the possibility of accidents is reduced?
Yeah, that
is that being done?
Yeah, that's a huge big issue. It has not been done much up till now, but everybody dealing with hydraulic fracturing is thinking about that seriously, especially in Marcellus, where waste water provision is not such a big issue as wastewater disposal is a huge big issue. So I know I've heard anecdotally that there is quite a lot of work going on basically 100% recycling, maybe with some sort of purification step in between. It would have to be a cheap purification step. But yes, that's high interest.
Is it possible in drilling to go around properties? Because one of the social issues that comes up is basically eminent domain. So compulsory integration, somebody doesn't want to give a gas lease, but if they're within a spacing unit, they can be compelled to do that. Can you drill around their property?
Yeah, this is a little like, can you run the electric power line or the water main around your property? Yeah, in principle, you could, but you wouldn't. And it doesn't make a lot of sense. Economically, certainly not economically, or legally. You want to unitize the field, which means you want to produce it as a unit. You can't. It doesn't make sense just to produce that and leave that.
It doesn't make sense to economically?
Well, or even physically. I mean, you can't sort of leave a hole in your production in the middle. yeah, that's not realistic. I've been to talks at Harvard Law School on this subject, and basically there is the thought that fields need to be unitized. There'll be an eminent domain type procedure where you will be paid fair market value for the mineral rights. You don't actually see anything, of course. This is thousands of feet below you. It doesn't have any particular effect on you. But I think that's basically the opinion of sort of legal people who have thought about this.
So a geochemical question. Does the shale produce oil, too?
That's a great question. You might have noticed that oil is $90 a barrel and shale and gas is $4 an MCF. The natural ratio is 6-1. So oil is at least 4 times more valuable than gas in today's world. Now, that said, whenever somebody drills into the shale and finds any oil at all, wow, that's like fantastic, we found oil. So right now, people are really going after shale-associated oil. And we don't understand that resource very well. We don't understand how it's flowing out of the rock because it's the two orders of magnitude greater viscosity that you have to deal with in this tiny pore space. But that's a very big issue in the industry. And there's this Eagle Ford play in South Texas that is nothing but what you're describing. It doesn't exist everywhere. There is a little bit of oil in Marcellus out in West New York, which is not commercial. But that's a point of concern just because of the huge differential in prices.
Your last slide was the big picture. I'll ask you a big picture question. We know that we have to eventually move to technologies that are carbon neutral, that aren't emitting some. And even though we save with gas over coal, we're still emitting CO2.
Yeah.
We know that if we continue to make fossil fuels cheap, we will not encourage a whole industry that we need to get going. So how do we work through that issue?
Yeah. That's a very good question, and it's one I'm very concerned about. I'm going to reinforce your question and make it even harder. In order to stabilize the atmosphere at something like either 450 or 500 ppm, Right now we're at 390. In order to stabilize the atmosphere at either 450 or 500, I forget which, we would have to be as in carbon intense as Nigeria. In other words, 4%. Nigeria uses 1/25 as much fossil fuel as we do. We would have to cut our CO2 emissions by 96%. That is quite a task. Now, certainly renewables are part of the answer, absolutely. If you saw the December issue of the Atlantic Monthly, there's a fascinating article about CO2 sequestration from coal-fired power plants. It turns out the world leader in that is China. The reason is China can build a coal-fired power plant in 21 months. They're very interested in this problem, and they are experimenting with solutions to it. So in other words, you capture the carbon dioxide one way or another, there's several approaches, and then pump it underground into a stable, geologically stable reservoir where it will stay forever, and that's safe. And there are naturally occurring CO2 reservoirs underground, so we know that works. That is another possible part of the answer. Schlumberger, the company I work for, has a carbon services unit that has worked out all the technology to do that. We are thinking of disbanding that unit because we were discouraged by what's happened in the last 2 years in Congress.
In what?
In Congress. Yes. Very discouraging from the standpoint of those who would want to solve the problem. Use that part. I mean, we're going to have to do everything to solve the carbon problem. But it's very discouraging, to be quite frank.
So you add things to the water.
Yes.
And these, I guess, formulations have, they're not patented, right? And so they're kept to be trade secrets and, right?
And some,
they're not released to the EPA. And so I guess one of the concerns is that you're pumping stuff in through our groundwater and it's not being proposed to disclose what those things are. And to make matters worse, in the last few years, these additives were sort of given a line item exemption from the Clean Water and Air Act.
Safe Drinking Water Act.
Yeah.
Yes.
So how do you make that problem go away?
Yeah. There are two solutions. One was introduced in the last session of Congress in both the Senate and the House called the Fracture Responsibility and Disclosure or something like that. The acronym was FRAC. It was introduced and never got to a vote. So that would be one way to solve it by legislation, and we can do that. Although I think the prospects are dimming. The other approach is for companies to take it upon themselves to disclose. Now, and there are two schools of thought in this regard. Let me skip to another slide. This is the slate of chemicals that one contractor, the one I work for, has put up on its website. The SW is the very popular slick water formulation. This is probably used in a majority of cases. And then there's this other linear gel formulation. So we have, that is to say, this company has disclosed what it uses in wells. Now, there's others that disagree with that. And I would say that's a matter of controversy in the industry. I think that if there's either pressure from the government through the FRAC Act, the FRAC bill that was proposed, or citizens, I think industry might go more toward disclosure, which I think would be a good thing. I think it would be healthy all the way around. That's my own personal opinion, by the way. I'm not speaking for anybody or anything except myself.
Following up on that, why don't the more responsible, technically capable, and deep pockets members of the industry press for the kind of legislation that would reduce the possibility of difficulties and drive some of the marginal operators who are going to do it on the cheap out?
You mean like you don't want Cabot drilling in your backyard?
You choose.
That was off the record, by the way. No comment. I mean, yeah, perfectly sensible, but nobody controls the market. It's a diverse market, and we need to go to, I would say probably your best bet is state regulators. And you know, what's going on now is really fascinating. I mean, I learned in elementary school that the states were laboratories of democracy. I like that phrase. And we have a fascinating experiment going on now. We have Pennsylvania, which is, go do it. You know, like, you know, they've got it. They've got a state DEP, which is a good DEP. It's good people. State university, very good geologists. But they're basically got the attitude of, we like this development. New York State has, as you know, a moratorium on drilling. So we are running an experiment side by side, two rather similar states, taking different approaches. In 5 years, I think we're going to have an answer. So, you know, I think a federal solution is the right way to go. We're not going to get it. So in the meantime, the states need to step up, and they are in their own ways. And I think it's going to be interesting.
Yes, on one of your graphs, it indicated that there was a, before the Marcellus became feasible and came on the scene, there was a 50-year supply of natural gas being maintained. So that must have been the old Trenton, Black River sort of scenario. If it turned out that we needed a bridge fuel, a long-term process to switch over to renewables, and the liabilities of hydrofracking, particularly the Marcellus, were much greater than the Trenton production liabilities. Tom Rose is another geologist down in West Virginia who I've spoken to, says that seismic advances, technology, has made finding the Trenton pockets much easier. Is it altogether out of the question in your mind that if it becomes highly questionable that hydrofracking the Marcellus can be done with fair assurance, is it altogether out of the question to return and continue with the Trenton production?
Yeah, okay, so first I'm just going to say I'm not exactly sure what you mean by Trenton. There is a Triassic. Conventional gas.
That's one formation of conventional gas in New York State.
In New York State. I'm sorry. Okay, I was thinking Triassic, you know, that goes through Trenton, New Jersey. Okay, forget it. Which is a different thing altogether. Okay, yeah, conventional gas. So, there is a multi-part answer to that question. Okay, where does gas come from? You're right. The technology of finding gas has improved, and we're much better, and that's why we're able to maintain that 50-year supply, and that's good. However, the gas shale gas is cheaper than conventional gas, and this shocked me. I mean, because despite having to bring these trucks in and all this water and fracking and whatever, it turns out that you can produce gas in Pennsylvania for $4 an MCF. It's more expensive out where people were drilling in 2007, 2008, out in the fields I'm familiar with, which is Western Colorado and Piñon Basin, Gulf of Mexico.
How much more expensive?
I might have that slide, if you'll excuse me. Let's see if I've got it here in this pack. Yeah, I think I do. Here we go. Okay. The green is shale plays and the blue are conventionals. Marcellus, this is really just amazes me actually. This is less than $4 an MCF. This is fairly new data. This is, our management was presenting this last year. So this is coal bed methane, of which there is not a huge amount. That seems to be pretty cheap. These are conventional. Pinedale is in the west. Haynesville is a gas shale in Louisiana. Fayetteville is in Arkansas. So this is shocking that even with all this technology and all this pumping and all that stuff, nonetheless, shale gas is what's keeping the price down at $4. Now, before this came on stream, we did have this big supply of domestic gas, but nonetheless, we were importing 16% of our gas. Now we're only importing 12% of our gas because basically we're undercutting Qatar after shipping, and we're undercutting Trinidad Tobago after shipping. That's sort of what's driving it. It's just very economical, and it's a domestic U.S. resource that we don't have to ship any dollars overseas for. So that's sort of what, yeah. I think I probably should have put this in the talk. It's a very central issue.
So the Woodford Fringe, is that a shale gas?
Yeah, Woodford is shale.
So you're getting some of the conventional is below that then, right?
Yes, yeah, mm-hmm. That's right.
And what would you say, just off the top of your head, is the differential there economically? It's not a factor.
You mean if we took gas shale out of production?
Well, just comparing right there, you have $5 for some of your shale, and you have $6 for some of your conventional.
Mm-hmm.
You also have $8. Okay. Is there any other part of that question that besides the economical part of the answer? Economics? You were saying it's a multi-answer question.
Let's see. Okay, so one was the fact that gas shale is more economical than conventional. The second is that our imports have gone down by quite a bit, and that's worth about $850 billion a year. That's a lot of money. No, that can't be right. I had the number written down somewhere. It's a lot of money. Oh, 850 BCF. So $5 billion a year in foregone imports. So there's the price, there was the imports. I guess, those are the two things that are sort of foremost in my mind. Yeah.
At this point, I would like to show our appreciation to Bob Kleinberg as the Moses Pass lecturer by presenting you with this plaque that honors your lecture here.
Thank you.
And in view of the late hour, I think it's appropriate that we thank again our speaker. And those who still have questions, I'm sure Bob will be happy to try to answer them in private audience right after.